there have been a lot of activists and legal scholars who have said, let's think about climate migration as a human rights issue. If people are kind of struggling in areas affected by drought and floods and so on, their human rights to safety and health is being violated by countries in the global north.
Hello and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. My name is Nicole Rivas, and I'm joined today by my co-host Julia Ahn. Climate change has rendered some parts of the world uninhabitable, prompting millions of people to be displaced. This is especially the case for already vulnerable populations in regions that bear most of the burden of rising temperatures due to greenhouse gas emissions. The legal categorization of climate migrants, or climate refugees, is a hotly contested issue that will have serious implications for those displaced by climate catastrophes. To discuss issues related to climate-driven migration, joining us today is Dr. Alil Benjamin.
Dr. Alil Benjamin is a senior lecturer in the sociology department at Johns Hopkins University and specializes in international humanitarian organizations and refugee policies in Israel, Palestine, and Southern Europe. Her work explores how NGOs attempt to combine life-saving and human rights advocacy in conflict zones. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Alil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole. Nice to see you again. Nice to see you, Julia.
So what do we mean when we say climate migrants? Who are they and where are they located?
Okay, so climate migration. It's been a huge kind of topic and a huge buzz term, climate refugee, environmental refugee. Since the 1990s, there's been growing interest. Just as we've seen growing interest and concern about climate change and activism, we've also seen growing interest and attention to the term climate migrant or climate refugee. And so the definition of climate refugee is really tricky and dependent on your own political and intellectual background. Let me give you a little bit of history as I've seen it. So in 2014, a 36-year-old farm worker from the Pacific island of Kiribati, spelled Kiribati but pronounced Kiribati, a man named Ayoni Tesiota, was caught in New Zealand with a broken taillight on his car. He was a migrant worker from this island, and he had come to New Zealand about 4 years earlier to work on a farm. And he had a wife, and he had had three kids in New Zealand, three small kids, 2, 4, and 6 years old. He considered himself an economic migrant, not a climate migrant, even though he had come from a Pacific island nation where increasingly potable water was more and more scarce. The outer islands of Kiribati, a nation of 33 atolls, kind of were increasingly being flooded. Drinking water was contaminated by seawater. So the vast majority of the population on the island are directly affected by the effects of climate change every day. Despite this, though, he didn't think of himself or didn't describe himself as a climate migrant. He described himself as an economic migrant, really just wanted to stay and work in New Zealand and had come to New Zealand on a worker visa. In 2011, when he was caught by a patrol officer for having a broken taillight because he had overstayed his visa and they looked at his ID and saw that he had overstayed his work visa, he was arrested and placed in jail. The lawyer that subsequently took him on, Michael Kidd, took him on pro bono, said this would be a perfect poster child for climate migration. This man who comes from a drowning island, these were the words of this lawyer, he is the person we can take and use as a case study to try to globally make the argument that climate migration is real, that people are migrating because of climate, and that wealthy democracies, not necessarily New Zealand, but the ones that are most responsible for polluting, have a moral responsibility to provide these migrants with protection. It came as a surprise to this migrant, and this is important because Tesiota has never really wanted to be considered a climate migrant, didn't describe himself as such. And in fact, when his case made global news, he was a little bit embarrassed and expressed some regret to reporters, saying, my home country and people back home think I'm embarrassing the island by describing myself as a climate migrant. Many people don't want to leave their island. They're very proud. Our identity is so much tied to the land. But it's more the global refugee kind of discourse that paints us as climate migrants, as people who are helpless, vulnerable, want to leave. And I'm ashamed. I would not want to go home because they would probably greet me at the airport with tomatoes thrown at me to get me to go back to New Zealand. So he made it very clear that it wasn't really his idea to call himself a climate worker. He did want to stay in New Zealand, but he just wanted to stay as a worker. And the reason I'm starting with this story is because we often see this as being the case that would-be climate migrants or people who are most affected by climate change, who are often being talked about as climate migrants and are being described as climate migrants from above by others. And it's become something of a pet project for various human rights activists. And it's not been very clearly a grassroots bottom-up movement to argue for climate. So that's really important. So this lawyer, Michael Kidd, took him on and argued to the New Zealand Supreme Court that he should receive refugee status because he has a well-founded fear of going back home due to the effects of climate change. The capital of Kiribati, Tarawa, is overcrowded, polluted. There's very little drinking water. There's no sanitation systems. And so the argument that the lawyer made was that this man would suffer extreme hardship if he were to return. As you can probably guess, this case did not succeed. The Supreme Court accepted, the New Zealand Supreme Court accepted that Te Sioto would be under extreme hardship if sent back home, but said that it doesn't fit, that the suffering he would experience doesn't fit into the existing global refugee regime. He doesn't count as a true refugee. And Jason Priestley, the judge, said, it's not my place to redefine what a refugee means. Climate does not qualify for refugee status. And so, unfortunately, his case was denied. He was deported back home the following year in 2015 to Kiribati. Now, that raises the question of, what exactly is this international refugee regime? How do you define a refugee, and why doesn't climate fit very well? So to think about there have always been people fleeing their home countries for reasons of violence and persecution. But when we talk about refugee in the contemporary context, we're usually talking about the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention that was devised in the wake of World War II. The backstory to that, very briefly, was that there was a German ocean liner, MSS St. Louis, that in the 1930s was carrying 937 Jewish refugees who were trying to escape Hitler in Germany. They docked in Cuba, in the United States, and in Canada, and sought asylum in all three countries. All three countries denied them asylum. They were sent back to Germany, where about a third of them died, and the rest were sent to concentration camps. After World War II, there was a period of reckoning, where the newly formed United Nations stated, we're not going to let this happen again. We're not going to allow people to flee war and violence and seek help elsewhere and be turned away and sent back to their deaths. Hence, the Refugee Convention. The Refugee Convention, which came into effect in 1951, defines a refugee as someone who is being persecuted back home, targeted specifically for reasons of religion, race, political opinion, nationality, or membership in a social group. So, for example, if you are a Muslim in current Modi India, and you're being persecuted for practicing Islam, you can flee elsewhere and apply for asylum on grounds of persecution. If you identify as transgender, or if you are in a country where same-sex sexual behavior or where sexual minorities are outlawed or criminalized, you can flee and seek asylum elsewhere and say, I will be attacked and targeted if I go back home. Now, importantly, this convention hinges on the notion of non-refoulement, which means not pushing back. So if someone has fled their home country, leaves country X, arrives in country Y and says, I would like to seek asylum, I believe I'm a refugee, if I've sent back home, I will be persecuted and I could be killed, then that country, the new country that signed the convention, has an obligation, a legal obligation, to in good faith adjudicate that person's claim. You can't just send them back. You can't refoul them or push them back. You have to adjudicate their claim. And so the Refugee Convention states that if someone has arrived in your home country and says they have this well-founded fear, you have to adjudicate their case fair and square. Now, there are important reasons for why climate is not a very good fit for the Refugee Convention. Would you like to hazard some guesses, or should I just keep going?
Nicole, do you have any guesses?
So why do you think climate change might not, or for example, this farmer's case, Tistiota, how does he or doesn't he match the Refugee Convention in your view?
So he's not necessarily being persecuted by any part of his identity. And it's also, I guess one could argue, even like, why can we say that he has to move because of climate? Like, why do we have to say that the reason he's moving is because of climate change? It's kind of hard to, you know, pinpoint the reason.
Yeah,
exactly. So you've hit really good ones. Sorry, go ahead, Julia.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting. I was going to add, and I was even going to ask you about this as a follow-up. Like, it's sort of hard to kind of decipher whether someone is migrating because of climate change or because of a natural disaster that might not be related. I think that on that point, it might be hard to prove, especially for people who might already be skeptical of climate change or might just not be as interested in it. And so how can we even prove that to people on a legal side that it's climate change and not a natural disaster that happened?
Exactly. And you can say natural disasters are more frequent and more severe because of climate. But as you've both said, it's very difficult to quantify the effects of climate. Climate change effects are they're not linear, they're not immediate. In many cases, the Refugee Convention really prioritizes immediate fleeing or immediate violence. For example, the Syrian dictator is persecuting you. You flee from Syria to Turkey. You have a clear persecutor. In the case of climate, there's no clear persecution. Climate affects everyone, of course, to different degrees because of how people are positioned in terms of their global privilege and wealth, among other things. But climate does not persecute you, and it's very difficult to quantify. So, for example, to Siota, this farm worker, if you were to ask him, why don't you want to go back to Kiribati, he would say mostly poverty and no opportunities for my children. In other words, he is drawing on the hallmarks of the discourse of economic migration, and economic migrants are not eligible for protection under the Refugee Convention. And this is something really important. The Refugee Convention from 1951 is kind of the main game in town. 150 states have signed it. Countries in the global north that use the Refugee Convention in order to adjudicate claims. If you have been persecuted for those five reasons I mentioned, race, religion, nationality, political opinion, so on, you have a chance of winning protection. But if you are simply poor, if you are fleeing a generalized violence, but you can't show that you were targeted, if you are fleeing due to climate, if you are internally displaced, meaning you haven't had the resources to cross an international border to seek asylum, but you've been displaced within your own country, none of these things qualify you for asylum. And so the Refugee Convention is often kind of described ironically as a conservative measure effort by the global north to keep out the global south. The rhetoric around the Refugee Convention is, here we are, the wealthy nations helping those who are affected by violence and persecution. But the critique that's often made across the board is that the Refugee Convention is designed to be deliberately narrow so that very few people would actually win asylum. Very few people would actually qualify. If you lost your land because elites have taken it, but you cannot really show that you were specifically persecuted, you don't have evidence, you're fleeing the extreme effects of poverty, you haven't had the resources to cross the international border, then you don't qualify for asylum. And so that's what Tasiota was kind of told. So that, just to kind of quickly sum up, climate is not a discrete factor that you can pinpoint to as a persecutor. It's more of a tipping point or a force multiplier. It interacts with other factors, but many judges would look at Tasiota's case and say, how do I know that your reasons for coming here are climate related? Like, yes, you're from a Pacific island, but your main reasons that you've stated are economic. Another reason is that climate kind of flips the direction of fleeing. If, for example, if you're a refugee from Syria and you're fleeing Syria to come to Germany, for example, you're fleeing your persecutor. But in this case, Tasiota is fleeing Kiribati and he wants to go to the global north that the global north is the most polluting. So you could argue he's going towards his persecutors instead of fleeing his persecutors. And so for all those reasons, climate would not probably find a very easy foothold within the existing refugee regime. It's not specific enough. It's difficult to quantify. It reverses the valence. Another important point is that the vast majority of climate migrants flee internally. I remember reading a study in Bangladesh that found that the average distance that climate migrants move to, for example, in Bangladesh from the coastal areas in the wake of a flood is 10 kilometers inland. That's the average distance. So a very small minority of climate migrants would actually have the resources or the means to cross an international border. Most of it is internal displacement. And so for that reason, the Refugee Convention wouldn't fit. And so it's been unfortunately very difficult for would-be climate migrants to argue, yes, I deserve protection under existing refugee law. There have been other legal instruments and regimes that have been suggested instead of the 1951 convention to account for climate, but they've also hit similar hurdles. I don't know if you want me to go into that.
No, I think, why don't we move on to the next question?
Okay.
And cool. If it doesn't catch that, if you can maybe go into that a little towards the end.
Okay. Sure.
Yes. So I guess from what I'm trying to analyze this from how does the legal categorization matter? It seems like it matters to the climate migrants maybe more easily to tell, because like it means the difference between whether or not they're being protected and the, you know, what comes with that. But it also seems to me, although maybe the criticism that the 1951 convention is conservative is valid, it also sounds to me that that also matters, because I think maybe a critic would think, well, if we broaden it, do different countries have the resources or the infrastructure to take in that many more people that would then be included by a broader definition? Does that sound about right, or am I missing?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. The question of capacity is really important. But even here, how many people exactly will be displaced due to climate is a really controversial question. Mm-hmm. There have been estimates from anywhere from 50 million to 250 million to 1 billion by the end of the century. There have been climate activists who have argued that more than half a billion people will be displaced due to climate. Unfortunately, that's provoked a strong backlash, not just from the right, but also by leftists. So of course you get the right wing backlash to that. Like, for example, you know, the word climate refugee is really exciting for climate activists. A lot of climate activists have really embraced the term climate refugee because it helps to amplify their case. It helps them to show, like, look, climate change is so horrific. We're even going to have hundreds of millions of people displaced due to climate change. It kind of makes them their bigger picture more urgent and makes people sit up and pay attention. But it also, unfortunately, has provoked a kind of backlash by conservatives and by state leaders who will say, well, 250 million people, we can't possibly take them in. We don't have the resources to take them in. And it's also made progressives kind of worry that the more alarmist the rhetoric around climate refugees, the less likely you are to win on the policy front. So you might expect, wow, climate refugee, a lot of leftists must be really rallying around this term. But actually, it's not been so clear cut. Some progressives really embrace the term climate refugee because they think, wow, it's a really good way to emphasize that the polluting global north that's most responsible for climate change has a moral responsibility to provide help to those who are victimized by their actions. And so it kind of draws attention to the issue of migration and climate, and it also emphasizes that those who have harmed must pay reparations, and that taking in refugees is just a small piece of what they owe to people who are victimized by their reckless actions. So that's kind of on the pro side. But on the con side, there have been quite a few refugee advocates who say the more alarmist rhetoric, the more states are likely to spook and say, no, I'm not going to sign on to this or that treaty because I don't want to pay to resettle folks. I don't want to pay to provide welfare for them. I don't want to, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of one concern that progressives have had. Some pragmatists like Jane McAdam and Matthew Scott, who've written extensively, they're legal scholars who've written extensively about climate migration. They say we need to move away from alarmist and say sensationalistic rhetoric, and we need to try to be more moderate and pursue more pragmatic solutions. Otherwise, you're going to have the activists shouting and screaming, climate refugee, climate refugee, and states are only going to stay where they've already been, and they're not going to be willing to make any major concessions. And the second reason, which kind of I mentioned at the beginning, that some progressives, refugee advocates, refugee scholars, and refugees themselves have been hesitant to embrace a term like climate refugee is because many people affected by climate don't want to leave. They don't want to leave their homeland, and I can tell you a little bit more about this, but they're worried that if the term climate refugee becomes the sole way that people see them, they'll be kind of framed instinctively as vulnerable, helpless victims, and their own desires, for example, to adapt to the existing situation, to build resilient communities, for example, to have flood-resistant crops paid for by, for example, aid agencies and so on, so they can stay in their homeland instead of leaving. They're really worried that they're not going to be listened to, that they're not going to be able to stay back home, that the global policy leaders will increasingly think, okay, well, these are refugees, you know, they're helpless, their islands are already doomed to sink. Let's not pour any money into adaptation techniques or into staying and kind of having them stay back home. Let's just take them in and continue polluting, or let's just take them in and treat them as victims. Many, many, many people who kind of are most affected by this don't find the term refugee very appealing, because they understand that their voices and their ideas and their priorities might not necessarily be respected.
Yeah, I mean, from what we've discussed so far, it sounds like there are a lot of nuanced perspectives at play here, and each potentially with a different idea of what they feel about the term climate refugees, you know, from the migrants themselves to climate activists, to the countries that are potentially taking in a lot of people. So are there any alternative framings of the issue of climate migration or climate migrants that maybe addresses some of the legal limitations of the refugee status that we've discussed a little bit earlier?
Yes. So as we've said, the 1951 Convention is too narrow and too persecution oriented to encompass climate. Some legal scholars have suggested that we look to statelessness as an alternative. Because, for example, if you are in an island nation and the islands are sinking with sea level rise, the kind of one thing that's been suggested is, well, people will flee Kiribati because it's sinking. They will become stateless. They will have no nationality. Their homeland will disappear. So let's consider them stateless people and grant them legal protections under statelessness treaties and proclamations that the wealthy global north countries have signed. But that's not very good either, because it's not likely to happen that way. People are not going to wait until the last, you know, palm tree on Kiribati is underwater before they flee. And they're not going to be airlifted a moment before their island nation sinks, and where they can arrive in the new country and say, I'm stateless, my island has sunk, please give me nationality where you are. That's not going to happen. What's most likely to happen instead is that people will leave long before the island sinks. The islands, kind of any other region that's very vulnerable, will become uninhabitable decades, if not centuries, before they actually are obliterated. And so the people will still be from Kiribati when they arrive in a new place, and they will not be stateless. They will still have the nationality. Their homeland will become less habitable. And so statelessness has not been so good. So we've already seen the Refugee Convention, not so good of a fit. Statelessness law also runs into important problems. Another important element has been maybe a new climate treaty. There has been a lot of debate and discussion. The Nansen Initiative of 2012 to 2015, the Paris Agreement. There have been a lot of different questions about whether there could be a climate migrant treaty that, for example, states would sign just like 1951. And then people who kind of are fleeing due to climate would then be able to claim protection. But that has fallen victim to the same kinds of concerns. For example, suppose there was a climate visa. How do we know that someone is truly fleeing due to climate? How do we separate out climate? How do we evaluate its effects? One direction that has been kind of different than all of these, which is maybe a little bit more promising in terms of providing protection, is human rights law. There have been a lot of activists and legal scholars who have said, let's think about climate migration as a human rights issue. If people are kind of struggling in areas affected by drought and floods and so on, their human rights to safety and health is being violated by countries in the global north. Countries that, for example, have signed the human right to health have an obligation to provide a safe and healthy environment for their citizens. Some would also say globally. And so maybe they're violating that by polluting to such an extent that people are struggling. And so maybe human rights law would be a better avenue. That also, though, is a little bit difficult because, for example, the European Court of Human Rights has been entertaining that perhaps dire humanitarian situations would constitute ill treatment by the government. If your government is not providing you with sufficient protection to have a healthy and sustainable life, if you are struggling so much with the effects of climate that you are not able to kind of live in your home country, then your government, which is not taking the necessary steps to protect you, is mistreating you And therefore, human rights law might be a good way to leverage that power against the states. But the problem with this, too, is that it's easy to fudge. The problem is really that states can also always argue back, well, we are trying to cope with the effects of climate. We are trying to resettle communities on the, for example, Japan in the wake of the 2011 tsunami has been trying to move seaside communities inland. Many communities resisted. They want to stay on the coastline, saying that they're more vulnerable if they move inland because they can't use their existing knowledge, cultures and practices to see when a tsunami is coming. They can't see the birds fleeing. They can't see the sky darkening as much. So they really wanted to stay in the front and, you know, on the coast. Should such an event happen again and the communities are still seaside, the Japanese government can always say, well, we did try to move you inland. We are trying to provide protection, you know, so it would be very difficult to use human rights law to protect climate migrants, but it's not necessarily impossible. I do think that human rights activism is very important and that framing climate migration as a human rights issue is potentially going to not only sustain attention to the situation, but also push novel instruments. I should say that even now, there are already some existing policy measures that have been used to address climate migration. One of them is temporary humanitarian visas, and then the other one is temporary protected status. So in the United States, for example, and in other countries like New Zealand, there have been cases of people fleeing environmental disasters who have been permitted to stay. For example, Hurricane Maria in the United States, Japanese tsunami in New Zealand. In other words, there have been examples of temporary visas for people who are fleeing. The problem with these visas is that they don't necessarily give you the right to stay. In fact, in most cases, they are temporary. You might be able to stay temporarily, but you in most cases would not be able to obtain citizenship in that country. So, and also if what's ailing you is not a discrete disaster, if it's just the slow burn of climate change making crops more scarce every year, and it's not just something very dramatic, then you're probably not going to get such a visa. And you're not going to be able to use it to immigrate permanently. So these measures are easier to get host governments to sign on to because they don't have to give very much to grant them. And they're not committing to taking in millions of people permanently. They can tell their constituents, look, it's just a temporary protected status. We can revoke it at any moment and then send these people back home. They're not going to become citizens. So they can argue to their own conservative kind of constituents, we're not actually allowing a flood of migrants here. This is just temporary protected status. So those things do already exist. There are also worker programs that are dedicated to kind of targeting would-be climate migrants in climate vulnerable areas. New Zealand, for example, the program that Te Ciota came to New Zealand on from Kiribati was a worker program specifically dedicated to helping people in areas vulnerable to climate change. But it's not described as a climate visa. It's described as a work visa. So those things also can help those who can work and offer them a temporary solution, although it really is a question of what happens if you're not able-bodied, what happens if you're a child, what happens if you're not able to work. Will those programs actually provide sufficient protection?
So we sort of discussed the shortcomings of existing international frameworks for handling climate migration and related issues. And I guess I would say the question of who should bear the responsibility of climate change, the implicit question of like who should bear the responsibility of those displaced by climate catastrophes is there too. So I guess my question is who should be doing more to address climate migration and what are the steps that they can take right away?
Okay, so this is a great question. I think definitely countries in the global north that are most complicit in the creation of these most disastrous changes have an obligation. But what's interesting though is if you ask young people, for example, in the island nation of Tuvalu, there's an interesting article I can send you. What do you want the wealthy nations to do? Do you want to become climate refugees? Do you want to leave these islands? The vast majority of them will say, no, we don't actually want to migrate. We want to stay in our homeland. This is our identity. We are not who we are without our land. But we want money from wealthy governments to boost our agriculture. We want flood-resistant crops. We want to build sea levees that are more effective. We need money for concrete to protect our homes from the rising waves every year. We need more money to import potable water. We need money to bolster our communities. Send us money so we can stay here. Don't bring us over there as helpless victims. This is the voice that you overwhelmingly hear from people most affected by climate. You see kind of really resilient, determined. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people who have no choice but to leave and who do seek protection. That does happen, yes. So I don't want to create the impression that climate migration is a figment of privileged global northerners' imagination. It isn't. It does happen. But the term refugee is often, in this case, a climate refugee, is often a top-down kind of label given to people rather than an organic self-realization that they come to on their own. And I have to also say, you know, when I worked in a medical NGO in Israel 10 years ago called Physicians for Human Rights, and a lot of the patients that came were asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea who had fled through the Sinai Desert, kind of fleeing civil violence in Sudan and forced military conscription in Eritrea. And what was really heartbreaking for a lot of NGO workers to hear is that when they arrived at the Egyptian-Israeli border, a lot of these asylum seekers, even though many of them had UN refugee documents, in other words, they had already been interviewed somewhere by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugee Office, and many of them had refugee documents, when the Israeli military stopped them and said, "Why are you here?" the majority of them said, "I came to work." In other words, they didn't have a consciousness of themselves as refugees fleeing their home countries. The majority of them said, "I came to work." They didn't want the refugee label. It was stigmatizing for them. They wanted to show they could be useful to the Israeli economy by contributing their labor. They didn't really realize that if they said, "I came to work," they would be stigmatized as economic migrants, and their chances of winning asylum would be significantly reduced. Because an Israeli asylum judge would say, "Well, you said you came to work, you're an economic migrant, we don't owe you any protection. If you said you're a refugee and you showed us evidence of persecution, we might offer you protection." But in this case, you see that many people, even if they have fled extreme violence, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to describe themselves as refugees. For many people, that name, that label carries a significant stigma. And they're worried that they might not have agency or might not be given agency to pursue the livelihoods that they wish if they describe themselves purely as refugee. Similarly, Tesiota and other would-be climate migrants note that Tesiota was taken on by an Australian lawyer who took his case pro bono and said this would be the perfect poster child for climate refugees. It's not the farm worker's idea. Yes, of course, he is aware of the fact that climate has made life in his home country, climate change has made life in his home country very difficult, but he doesn't necessarily see that as a climate migration situation. There is a political kind of process that needs to take place for those kinds of representations to stick and become global news. And I think that's also important. That's why many progressives are concerned about a term like climate refugee, because they're saying, if we spend too much time thinking about refugees and migration, we're not going to dedicate enough effort to prevention and to adaptation in place. We're going to be too focused on helping people flee instead of helping them live sustainably where they already are.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to talking about taking responsibility, it also sounds like it's quite a complex issue. Like, how can you prove which countries are doing the most that lead to that specific catastrophe happening? And then even then, how can we make those countries actually do something? I guess to kind of end us on maybe a more positive note, are there steps that are effective that are being taken?
That's a great question. I think, like I've already said, I think that the existing temporary protected status visas and humanitarian visas are a good response if there is a concrete immediate disaster and people need a place to live for a while. It's obviously not going to provide a long-term solution for large populations affected by slow-burning effects of climate. Another kind of important response is activism in general, human rights activism, framing it as an important human rights issue. But I think what needs to be done more that's not being done as much is attention to adaptation in place. Different states that have discussed are discussing global responses to climate change are hesitant to pour a lot of money into adaptation in place because you're thinking it's not a good use of money. These islands are going to sink pretty soon anyway. We might as well just bite the bullet and take these people in instead of pouring billions and billions of dollars into shoring up communities that are not ultimately going to be able to sustain themselves on these pieces of land. We might as well just move, kind of accept the reality of migration and focus on that. But that's not really what the vast majority of these communities want. And there's been a great deal of really important and interesting research on this. If you ask people, they will usually say, of course, I want to stay home. I don't want to migrate. I also think that the voluntary worker programs that have been devised by kind of New Zealanders and so on and other governments are a good idea, but they don't offer, obviously, a solution to those who are not young and able-bodied and highly and skilled, trainable. They take in young and workers who can work in jobs that fulfill particular holes in that economy, but they're not necessarily helpful to others. One of the things I want to emphasize is that treaties devised in the Global South have always been leading the way, way ahead of European governments. So in 1969, the Organization for African Unity devised a new refugee convention where they made way for potentially including the effects of climate change in 1969. So whereas the 1951 convention talks about political persecution and you only qualify for refugee status if you are persecuted for those five reasons, the 1969 convention devised by the Organization for African Unity includes people who are displaced from their habitual place of residence. In other words, you don't have to cross an international border. You can be displaced internally and still qualify for protection. They also include events seriously disturbing the public order, quote unquote. And those things can be extreme economic hardship. They could be climate change. There's also a 1984 refugee declaration signed by 10 countries in Latin America that also makes way for environment and climate to be granted, kind of to be given or recognized as legitimate reasons for providing protection. Unfortunately, neither the 1969 nor the 1984 declarations were signed by, you know, the United States, any countries in Western Europe. You know, they were all signed by 1984 by 10 countries in Latin America and the 1969 convention by 45 members of the African Union. And so these newer regional declarations are maybe the way forward. We already see, for example, the 2009 kind of Kampala Convention, which described new protections that would be given to people fleeing the effects of climate and armed conflict, already lay out in fairly compelling terms policy solutions that you know, wealthy democracies in the global north just don't want to sign. I think the biggest challenge here is just will. Wealthy, you know, neoliberal democracies are not interested in bringing in more people. Even 1951, the 1951 convention, which is fairly narrowly conceived, even if you do qualify, it's very difficult for you to win asylum. It's very difficult for you to win protection. Countries in the global north, like the United States, for example, takes numerous steps to prevent asylum seekers from even arriving at their borders in order to seek protection. If you arrive, you fly into JFK Airport and you say, I'm an asylum seeker, I don't want to return to my home country, please give me protection. Your chances of actually winning asylum are very limited. You're most likely going to be detained. You're most likely going to be questioned and your credibility will be doubted of the 150,000 asylum seekers who sought asylum in the United States in 2019, about 45,000 were granted, so about a third. So your chances of winning asylum, even if you kind of are coming in as a 1951 refugee, are anywhere from 25 to 40% usually. It's very, very difficult to win asylum, even as a political refugee under the convention, even if you kind of qualify. So for wealthy democracies to now suddenly give protection to potentially millions or hundreds of millions of climate migrants, that is an extremely tall order. It's not going to happen. And that's why Jane McAdam, who is an Australian legal scholar who wrote the first and most important, to my mind, book about this in 2011 that I can send you, she argues that we need to look away from global treaties that are dedicated to climate migration, that we're just not going to get governments to sign them, wealthy governments to sign them. They're not going to be willing to assume responsibility. Instead, what we should be looking for is adaptation in place. We should be pouring a lot more money into that, and also to regional cooperation. The effects of climate are so different depending on where you are that it makes no sense to kind of work on international cooperation. That's going to take decades, if not centuries, to come to any actionable policy. Instead, we should kind of look to smaller commitments at kind of much more local and domestic levels. And that's really what's going to be the most feasible approach. But of course, that's not as sexy when you are a climate activist and when you really want to sound the global horn for climate refugees.
Well, Alil, thanks so much for such a great conversation. It's been a very far-reaching conversation, and there's still so much to talk about. I wish we had more time. And you kind of already, suggested a book if we were
wanting
to learn more. So if you could, what are some sources if listeners want to learn more?
Okay. I'm really glad you asked. The two of the most important legal scholars who have written a great deal about climate refugees are Jane McAdam and Matthew Scott. Google those names. Find their books. Jane McAdam, their books are both called very different, very similar things. So Jane McAdam's book is Climate Change, Forced Migration, and International Law. Even though it's over 10 years old, it's still remarkably prescient and remarkably current in my view. Also, if you look up a foreign policy article by Kenneth Weiss called The Making of a Climate Refugee, you'll learn a lot more about Te Ciota, the farm worker from Kiribati, about his story and why it was so difficult in his case to argue that he is a climate migrant and to win protection in New Zealand. I'm also happy to share other links and other books for those who are interested in learning more about the topic.
Awesome. Hello, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.